So the reading from the TED Talk, that was about half of the talk, so I do encourage you to check out the rest of it. Finishing the part of what he wears for funerals, it's turquoise and yellow, I think, and one other color. And that creates the sound that works for a funeral. My experiences of Hindu devotional worship or puja in Sri Lanka were eye-opening and ear-opening and nostril-opening and taste bud-opening and most of all, heart-opening. So in Hindu worship, puja, as they call it, vibrant, even torrid colors are there in the art and the flowers, in the clothing that the icons, the gods and goddesses are dressed in. I had never seen such a feast of color in worship. And the noise, priests chanting loudly, instruments bellowing like the shehnai and oboe on steroids, bells clanging. Puja generally is not quiet and contemplative. It is a cacophony. Typically, Hindu worship also includes food. Food is offered to the gods, and that which is thought to not be eaten by the gods is returned to the devotees. And it's an olfactory banquet, too, with incense burning, and typically there's a lot of people crammed together, standing, it's hot, and so there's the smell of sweat as well. Hindu worship is truly a full-body experience. I remember the first few pujas just absolutely overwhelming my senses. I walked out of the worship area with my eyes blinking, my ears ringing, the odor of incense mixed with the sweat burning in my nose, and the hyper-sweetness of the food offerings still lingering in my mouth. I was not in a spare liberal Protestant service anymore. At the very first puja I attended, a devotee went into a wild trance and danced unlike anything I had ever seen before or have seen since. This woman's heart and soul were cracked open by this ritual, and I could see why that happened. The picture on the screen is from a Hindu festival called Holi. Held each spring, Holi includes a bonfire on the first night, and then the next day, a celebration of colors. Worshippers chase each other, launching dry colors mixed with water at one another, sometimes with squirt guns. Here are some photos, the next three from my daughter and her fiancé at a Holi celebration in Chicago. During the playful festivities, anyone is fair game for the colors. And so you throw them at friends, at acquaintances, at strangers, even at enemies. Prerna Kualvik has memories, hot, powerful memories of Holi as a kid. And she remembers more than anything seeing her parents just playing, like launching these colors at people in a way that she did not see ordinarily. There are no class distinctions in Holi. Everybody's included, everybody's fair game. So it's a celebration not just of the spring, but of the underlying unity that ties all of us together, like the rainbow symbol in our culture. The vivid colors of Holi offer a potent visual symbol of humanity's underlying unity amidst its resplendent diversity. So our journey group packet, that's the packet of material that goes out to journey group participants each month, along with the worship and learning theme. This week, that journey group packet asserts that Unitarian Universalism stands on the side of technicolor. I'm not so sure. With our roots on the radical fringe of Protestantism, our worship has historically tended toward the monochromatic. Think of the Puritans and their sparse worship and architecture in this country, and the Puritans were us. They are our spiritual ancestors. There's a beauty I love in the historic New England Unitarian or Universalist or Congregationalist churches, but they are rather monochromatic. And the worship style, truth be told, the skin color of our ancestors reflected that monochromatic architecture. There's a lot to be proud of about our ancestors, but technicolor, not really a word I'd use for the Puritans. During most of the past century, our Unitarian Universalist worship has become monochromatic in another important way. It has become all head, no heart. The sparseness of the space increasingly became reflected in the sparseness of our worship and the utter lack of emotional content. Our fellowship in the past 30 years has been part of a growing movement to include more feeling in our Unitarian Universalist services. We're not seeking to banish the mind, but to balance the mind with emotions. If I had to visualize what this trend looks like in colors, I'd see a metamorphosis from a monochromatic color scheme to a bright rainbow. And all this brings me to our new sanctuary. One of my favorite things about this space is that it celebrates color. From the rich colors of the chairs and the carpeting, and I was sitting out there just now thinking, and this, which I don't see from here, but is so bright and colorful, to the little strips of glass in the windows, and then the same colors echoed with the fabric on the acoustic panels to the flaming chalice window. This room is a celebration of color. I love that on sunny days, as Leah said, color reflected through those stained glass strips just gives people this amazing halo effect. It is really fun to be up here and see this. Sometimes you don't even know that it's happening. It's a beautiful thing. We have lately discovered an unexpected gift of color in this space. It turns out in the early spring, the late afternoon sun shines through the chalice window and creates some amazing effects up here. And the next three slides are pictures I've taken of this effect. Amazing. And I think our architect probably knew this would happen because he programmed what the light would be like in this room every day of the year. But for me, this was a complete surprise. Yesterday, as Dan was playing the closing hymn, the light from the red in the stained glass window illuminated his hands. And that's probably going to be like the last Saturday service of the year in May will be when that happens. Pretty cool. I'm so thankful to our architect, Doug Haas, and the folks on our interiors committee who championed the inclusion of color in this space. The color scheme does matter. It makes a statement, and it evokes and invites in a certain kind of spirit. We're also blessed in this congregation to have an amazing art committee and many fellowship artists who agree to show their work as part of our art committee's exhibits. The current exhibit focused on color is one of my favorite all-time exhibits here. And if you haven't had a chance to study the art, I hope you will. It's in our fellowship hall and the lobby outside this space. On a shoestring budget, literally $25 a year, our art committee does an amazing job. And as many of you who were here last weekend to hear the Reverend Karen Anderson speak, my colleague from the First Unitarian Church in Rochester, you probably aren't surprised to hear that she has an artist's eye. She loves the work of our art committee, and her reaction to our new sanctuary space is my favorite reaction yet. For several minutes, she heaped with vehemence curses on me. And I'm not going to repeat what she said, but the underlying sense was, I am insanely jealous of your space. So her church in Rochester dates to the 1950s. It was designed by the famous architect Louis Kahn, and it doesn't have much color. What it has are gray cinder blocks, huge walls of gray cinder block. So I think for Karen, the evocative colors of this space spoke to her in a way perhaps her church back home does not. Vibrant colors truly light up our world. Like evocative sounds, delicious smells, delectable foods, they help us engage with life. Barbara Kingsolver writes, "In my own worst seasons, I've come back from the colorless world of despair by forcing myself to look hard for a long time at a single glorious thing, a flame of red geranium outside my bedroom window, and then another, my daughter in a yellow dress, and another, the perfect outline of a full dark sphere behind the crescent moon, until I learned to be in love with my life again. Like a stroke victim retraining new parts of the brain to grasp lost skills, I have taught myself joy over and over again by looking at color." I think Kingsolver is right. When we are feeling down, seeking out a color can be a way to help pick ourselves up. I suspect this is why the Hindu festival of Holi takes place in the spring. Even in the warmer climate of India, there's something about spring and its colors that can lift your spirit. Even more true here, especially after this past winter. My hope for the space in this new sanctuary and for the art in our building is that it will warm your heart and lift your spirits, even when it's bitter cold and mostly monochromatic, either within your spirit or outside with the weather. So I'd say we're doing pretty well at the fellowship as far as the visual aesthetic of the rainbow goes. But how much of a rainbow do we reflect in other ways? There's lots of categories to look at. I'll just talk about a few. I think our rainbow is increasingly bright in terms of our music program. Take some of our musical fare in recent weeks. A Beethoven concerto, a Talking Heads song, a Balinese gamelan ensemble, folk songs written by our own members, and this weekend, music by Sly Stone, Nora Jones, and John Lennon. That's a pretty good rainbow in my view. It's one of the many reasons I'm glad that we're able to move our music director to halftime. Having more of Jay Thomas here will help this rainbow get even more vivid and bright. We have long had a bright rainbow of theological and philosophical viewpoints here. It's part of what drew me to the fellowship in the first place, and it's only gotten richer in the last 24 years. Many a fellowship created in the 1950s has been completely unable to grow past the monochromatic theology of its founders. Here, though, our founders had more diverse viewpoints, and they welcomed a brighter and more varied theological rainbow. We are so lucky, and it has spared us some awful theological battles. A rainbow has gotten much brighter and more vivid in terms of sexual and gender identity. Of course, we had a lot of room for growth in this area. At least on the surface, we were pretty monochromatic when I arrived. There wasn't a single member who had come out as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer. We have the reputation now in town as the gay church. And if folks mean by this that our membership reflects what might actually be the proportion of LGBT folks in our population, well, then I guess that's a pretty good designation for us, and it works for me. Our rainbow has gotten somewhat brighter in terms of economic class and educational attainment, and at the same time, we have a long way to go just to reflect the community beyond our walls. And in terms of race and ethnicity, our fellowship looks like all but a precious few Unitarian Universalist congregations overwhelmingly white. Like a lot of our congregations, if you look a little harder, you'll find some diversity, especially among our children and youth. But we do not reflect the wider community beyond our walls, even in this area that is not as diverse as many. I continue to believe that the first step in our fellowships becoming more ethnically and racially diverse is for us individually and collectively to deepen our intercultural competence. In a nutshell, intercultural competence is the ability to communicate effectively and appropriately with people from a different culture from one's own. And I think there's four principal ways to develop our intercultural competence, again, as individuals and collectively. The first is to become knowledgeable about your own culture. One of the imperialisms of a cultural majority is its denial that it is a distinctive culture at all. Instead, it sees itself as the human norm. But every culture is distinctive. You can't begin to recognize and celebrate the distinctiveness of another culture if you don't admit your own culture also has distinctiveness. A second way to develop intercultural competence is to become more self-aware. In intercultural work, it's essential to be in touch with your deepest thoughts and feelings and to be aware of the impact of your words on others and your actions on others. And then the third way is developing empathy for folks from different cultures. And a final way is to deepen our knowledge of different cultures, other people's cultures. Knowledge and understanding, that's the doorway to empathy. There are plenty of ways to do this work of strengthening intercultural competence. Entering into interactions with someone from a different culture with humility, with openness, with self-awareness, and a desire to learn, that's a great place to start. Getting involved in the multitude of intercultural opportunities here in the Fox Valley, that's another way. And I hope that developing intercultural skills will be a major focus of our fellowship in the near future. It is the necessary first step to our becoming more significantly diverse in terms of race and ethnicity. Well, each month, our journey group participants engage in a spiritual exercise connected with the month's worship and learning theme. And so I want to close today by commending to you and encouraging you, inviting you to share in a variation of one of the exercises in this month's packet. What I invite you to do is each day join me in a simple daily assignment. Once a day, look hard for a long time at a single, glorious, colorful thing. Look at it. Soak in the color. Revel in the color. Contemplate it. Be grateful for it. And then I invite you to share that experience with another person or to journal about it. Maybe you'll contemplate a bright yellow from a daffodil in your yard or from one that you buy at the plant sale today. Or maybe you'll contemplate what E.E. Cummings calls the leaping, greenly spirits of trees, those just about ready to burst buds of leaves. This weekend is the peak for that, I think. Or maybe like Barbara Kingsolver, you'll notice the flame red of a geranium out your bedroom window or your daughter's bright yellow dress. My single glorious color that I'm contemplating this weekend is the red that's mostly on the left of the chalice flame, that deep, fiery red. I'm soaking that color in. I'm letting it speak to me. As I do so, I'm grateful for Linda Muldoon, the artist who created that window. I'm grateful for Sherry Gates, a deceased fellowship member who had a vision of having a chalice stained glass window in this space, and held on to that vision and made sure we all held on to it after she died. To me, this window honors Sherry. It's part of her legacy. So this weekend, as I look at that red especially, it is evoking joy from me. I'm letting it teach me how to love my life again.